The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Talking Monkeys, the official 12 Monkeys podcast. I'm your host, Meryl Barr, and joining me today is my co-host, Amy Marie. Amy, how are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm excited to talk monkeys. I'm not going to lie, I've been looking forward to this.
I am too. Oh. We're in the final season. So, what do you say? Let's go around the room. We got a lot of people here today. So, let's go around the room quickly and everyone introduce yourself.
I'm Christopher Monfette.
And you're a writer. You're a writer.
Yes.
Producer. Guy. Terry Metalis, showrunner thing.
Stephen Barton, I'm the composer.
Casey Botta, I'm the showrunner's assistant.
And Sean Tretta, I'm a writer-producer.
All right, guys, so we're in the home stretch. Final, I guess, 11 episodes, actually, right?
11, yeah. Final. Although 10 and 11 are kind of a two-hour movie, so they're kind of one giant thing.
All right, so this week we got episodes 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
And they started on... Well, before that, actually, can we do a recap? What happened at the end of... Last season. Take us back.
So, last season we end up with basically everybody dying. We're dead. things are hitting the fan. Ethan's dead. Jones is dying. Oh, and by the way, the witness is Olivia.
Oh, shit.
No big. So, we find out she's been orchestrating this whole thing. What we don't quite know as we enter this season is exactly how. And that was one of the big things that when we entered this season, I wanted to know where we were going. How has she been orchestrating all of this? What does this mean for our people? And then, of course, there's the little things like, oh, yeah, Titan's coming after us. How are we going to get out of the situation in the first place? So the season opens with a bang. It enters with us starting off right off the bat.
Well, we go back into medieval times.
Well, running with horses.
Well, Terry, what was up with that, with the medieval times stuff? And we go back
It's clearly a preview of what's to come. You know, it was the first time we ever did a real cold open where
it was astounding.
Where we're like, you're not going to know what's going on here.
Yeah,
you're
going to guess this one, guys.
Try to guess this
one. I was on the wrong show for a moment.
Yeah. Well, that was so great, you know. And then you have Donald Sumter, but there's elements that guy's we know he's a primary. There's a group of primaries, and we know what those guys are like, and what men and women are. And it's someone very witnessy is on horseback, so I think that's important. And then you go to that castle with a character named Nicodemus, and we'll wait to reveal her name.
Yeah.
And the Ouroboros Cryptex thing. So it was felt like a good teaser to be like, we have no idea what's going on, and you're like, is this even the show? And then remember the name James Cole.
It's
like
a good teaser. They're also teasing in that scene a weapon.
A weapon, yes, which is important.
It actually comes into play pretty heavily over the course of the season. But we go right in, and we're back in the action. Everything is going to haywire. Like, it has all hit the fan. You know, so, like, when you were writing, it felt like, especially in the first episode, like, it was just a massive battle. This huge, you know, Titan shows up, and the core is overloaded, and... We can't jump. Well, how are we going to get everyone out of here? And Jones is dying. Like, how did you go about structuring that that whole episode?
Well, that's
Jesus.
Yeah, I was going to say. I was look at Sean and everybody here. Season four is without question the hardest of all. Almost every single episode was really, really hard because of how much it needed to achieve emotionally and. mythology-wise, and then just be a good episode. But, yeah.
I mean, you know, coming off the cliffhanger, you have to jump into that action, like, right away. And part of the instinct was this, yes, it's going to be this, like, unrelenting battle thing. And the problem we have, the good problem, it's still a problem on the show, is that you're always balancing, like, you know, the action and sort of the adventure of it and the immediacy of stuff along with all the character development stuff. So part of it was like, we've got this great battle, we have to have this fight, and we have all this action. And by the way, we have to have set up all these new stories for this season.
And, you know, one of the things that shocked me is that you kill Lasky. You kill Whitney. And
So brutal.
It's one of those things where you think, you know, on a time travel show, how do you keep the stakes up? And then you go and you kill two of these characters who've been around with us for seasons.
Yeah. Well, also by the end of the episode, it's clear that Jones is not going to do well from her exposure to that thing. So, I mean, you have to. You're at the end, you know. And you know, Murray, who plays Lasky, is such a great sport about being killed constantly. And, you know, he's fantastic.
He's your Kenny.
Yeah, he's our Kenny, exactly. Yes. You know, that was a real. I mean, I think we went through maybe like 50 drafts of that episode. I mean, I think we started writing that episode while we were up in Prague with Ethan, yeah. And that was like four months before it even shot.
Yeah,
and there was actually a different version of it, which was like a loop episode where
it's actually a lot like another episode we will have this
season. Oh, yeah, we can't talk about it. Yeah, so yeah, but there was another version of this, maybe we'll talk about next week, that we went down. You wrote, like, didn't you actually write a whole draft of it? Yeah. Yeah, and we were just like, fuck, it doesn't work. And that was very common in season four, is we would have one or two drafts. Yeah. Before we were like, okay, now we know what it is. which normally some shows do in a first season, but we like just, it was very, very hard.
Was the splintering the facility away, was that always a part of it? Was just figuring out how to get around that? Or did that come about after
the We always knew that. We always knew. We set that up in season three with Project Karen, when she's like, Deacon comes and finds Jones and Adler, and she's like, make a hole here for Project Karen. And he's like, what the hell is Project Karen? So we set that up. We also set up episode two, where, not to jump ahead, but where Jones meets Jones.
Yeah.
Earlier last season, when she talks about being at the drinking
having
the bottle.
Hallucinations.
Yeah, yeah. In your episode 307. So it was so we had set all those things up, and we knew what we wanted to do. It was just, you know, also emotionally, like, coming in and finding where Cassie is, especially Cassie has a big journey this season, you have to start right away.
When, as far as the Jones meeting Jones stuff in episode two, we're going to jump around a little bit. You know, how did you get to the place where you were like, you know what? Jones is going to be like, fuck it. Let's just, you know, she's going to cause...
It's brilliant.
Screw causality.
It's fantastic.
Like, I'm just going to go talk to myself.
Jones of all people.
Well, we had to do... There was something that came up. We had to know we were going to do it. Yeah. We knew we were going to do it in episode all the way back in season three. So what happened at the top of season three is we mapped out these 20 episodes.
Yeah.
We had
knowing
to know
it was your knowing it was
knowing we're like we're at the midpoint now. So in order in 301 future Cole talking to Cole, we need to know what future Cole was saying and why he was saying that, and Cassie coming out with the streak in her hair and saying, you told him there was hope. We needed to know that scene, and that's a scene you're going to see in season four. So you have to, if you're going to know that much, you have to know all of it.
Yeah. And I think as we went into season four, we kind of knew narratively that we had to embrace the sort of the loops and tangles and the inherent intricacies of causality, and especially having Jones have the experience she has in 401, in 402, she's emboldened to go and make that choice and say, okay, I have to throw caution to the wind a little bit, to kind
and
of
she's dying.
Dig deep
in. You know, and she's dying. She's like, well, shit, I got to try something.
Right.
You know what I mean? So something's different. I mean, we got so far ahead that I think, musically, you started writing the sort of emotional piece while we were shooting the end of episode three, or the thing that became movies, Stephen wrote this piece that's sort of like, we call it the family
theme.
The family theme this season.
Yeah.
And we started working on that way back because we knew thematically where we had to, what the season four had to be.
And I love the music that we got, especially in the beginning. I mean, first off, we go all the way back, right at the opening. The whole segment felt so cinematic, but the music makes it.
Yeah, I mean, there's, well,
the
I
medieval.
Mean, yeah, oh no, 100%.
1000% when Terry first showed me this and was sort of gave outlined what he was thinking of doing. I mean, I think it was clear that, I mean, you could either consider this season itself as a movie, as a ten part movie, depending. And then within that, there's sort of, you know, like, I mean, you could even take sort of each sort of pair or of episodes or even each episode as being a sort of, you know, kind of motion picture experience on its own. I mean, it's just, it's so not, you know, like, I mean, it's almost, it's not television really. I mean, it's just, it's a whole different thing.
You had to dig in your medieval tools too.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, years ago I'd worked on a couple of films that sort of like kind of helped inform this. I'd worked on Kingdom of Heaven with Ridley Scott, and that was, you know, it was sort of, you know, kind of going into sort of similar territory to that. But it was, you know, like, but also trying to do it with the mindset of it being within our world. So that was one of the biggest sort of challenges of this season, is sort of everything, everywhere we go, it was sort of making sure it was something that was sort of within our sort of monkey's playbook.
Steven said, I was on set in season three. He, knowing we were going into the world, you wrote this sort of medieval piece.
Yeah, without knowing what it was.
And at the end of the piece, I was like, it was really, really interesting. It had all these different sounds that we end up using later in the season when we go on to it. But it crescendoed with this amazing emotional theme that you, I don't even know if you realized how good a theme it was. And so I said, I was like, wow, you really cracked this emotional theme that we need for this family. And you're like, what?
I did?
I was like, yeah. I was cool. Like, just take the medieval part of that thing out. And that became, the first time I think you really truly hear it is Cole's first Splinter, that big piece that happens is the first time you hear the theme of season four.
It was funny with that as well, because when I originally did that, I sent it as part of this thing that you were up in Canada, and I sent you the demo of it, and I didn't have any idea what it was going to become, or have really any idea what the sort of, you know, kind of thematic sort of thrust of this would be, and was really just sort of going off your ideas, and I think, I can't remember if I'd read a couple of the scripts at that point. But I can't even remember. Maybe not. I think we had
one through three or something.
But what is interesting that when we finally came to that scene with Cole's first Splinter, it was something where I was trying all sorts of things, and I was sort of just like coming, and suddenly you said like, well, you know, that you should put in this piece, and I'm like, oh, you know, that medieval thing, like, really? We took all the medieval instruments out, and then suddenly I think sort of that was the point where I kind of realized what he was getting at in terms of the there being a unified theme to this particular to the season. And I think that's something we generally do on movies. I mean, generally you look for, you know, an often thing we talk about is like, you look for the movie theme, you look for the theme that isn't necessarily attached to a character, but it's attached to a feeling or attached to a central sort of idea. And that was, I think that's what that this became. And from that, because you get that as a familiar friend throughout this season, it's sort of, you know, it is that sort of cinematic thing.
I sent it to you, so you should play it in the podcast, but I'll tell you which one it is so people know what it is.
Jumping back in narratively, we have to talk about Jennifer, who was in 2018 in episode one. Mm-hmm. We go to her. She's robbing a museum in a truly classic Jennifer moment where she, it's like she's in her head. In her head, she's living a spy fantasy. She's living a real Ocean's 12 kind of moment.
Yeah.
And then we find out, no, that's none of it. None of that is.
Jennifer's 12, I think, is what we call it. Yeah. I think that was the name of that heist episode last season, I think. Yeah.
What was that about? What went into writing that scene?
Well, we had her, like, originally, like, she was going to, we wanted to have her as, like, a spy in Europe and having an aesthetic that we never had for Jennifer. And I remember we were sitting there at breakfast one morning, and it was like, what if she went into the room and there were many Jennifers?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, okay, let's do something like that.
It was Mission Impossible with a lot of Jennifers. Yeah. Yeah. was the first crack at that, which I think
scaled back.
Well, actually, we went down production-wise. Like, I actually think in the second script, you did a pass where there was, like, a hacker Jennifer.
It was three Jennifers.
And it just actually made better sense for it to be a two-hander.
Yeah.
You know, you were going to get more bang for your buck than having nine Jennifers. You won't connect to any of them, but if you connected to one sort of badass...
Black Widow Jennifer.
Yeah. Black Widow Jennifer. But it's funny, you know, she... So Emily went and looked at Sigourney Weaver. She looked at every female
I got a real badass vibe from it is what I got.
She looked at that and she's like, I can't find this voice. And you remember what it is?
Lego Batman.
No. That's not what it was. That's not what she found. I said, go watch John McClane in Die Hard. Yeah. The first Die Hard. Because it's very quippy. And she's like, all right, I know.
Is this another movie she had never seen?
She actually was very good friends with Alan Rickman. She was destroyed when he passed. So she was like, I want to watch it anyway. And, after that and you can kind of hear it in some of her thing, like, chillax. It's totally John McClane doing that
and
thing.
And normal Jennifer told her to tone it down a little bit. It's driving her nuts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So.
I thought that was a great segment. Very entertaining. I laugh harder at the Jennifer moments than I do in almost any other show I watch. I mean, last season's E.T. bit. And this season, when the security guard is watching her slowly just flop like a fish across the museum floor, I was dying.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. That's true, Emily. I mean, it's like, yeah, I love the idea. You want the audience to, when she starts kicking ass, to be like, hold on. I never saw Jennifer do this.
Yeah.
I don't buy that Jennifer can do that. So then when you see her being like a six-year-old who's like, you know, that feels like our Jennifer.
I like the security guard also.
The security guard is such a great woman.
Yeah, he was a Prague local too. Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
He's got like that Shatner kind of look. He's like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't hard to get those guys to be like, Americans.
Yeah.
Because they were all like, Americans.
And, you know, it was good to see that section where we actually got a chance to see 2018 in the midst of the virus. Because we forget about that. We forget that ultimately the show started out trying to solve the virus problem.
Right.
And we forget that ultimately it's going to have to go back to that, which of course comes up later on in the season when we have to deal with the fact that some of our characters are realizing it and some of them aren't.
Yeah.
I think that frustrated me. You can go into it too.
We're going to get there. We will get to that. But when we're staying on the robbery for a second, what she steals turns out to be very important.
Yeah.
She steals
the Ouroboros.
The Ouroboros. That in episode two, we watch Cole solve.
Yeah, episode three.
Because episode two is when he and Cassie split, which tears you apart because they're always on the same page.
Yeah,
We
do have to get to that, them splitting apart, because that's a major insanity. But as far as the Ouroboros is concerned, that puzzle which leads them, it gives them a message. That says go to Black Leaf May 11th, 1852, which, I mean, we know what it means, but we can't, that comes later.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's something going on in 1852. I mean, where were you in the planning stage when that episode came up? And like, what's going to be on?
Done. There? Planned. Yeah. You couldn't. You needed all those clues. I mean, I think we did the clue thread.
So you were never winging it. This
was never a show we never could wing it.
You can. I mean, we shot stuff for episodes 1, 3, 6, like at the very end of our schedule.
Yeah.
Huge chunks of it. So we had that
in
all
Prague,
planned out.
So, yeah. So we knew we had to know the clue path. We had to know we were going to go to the Old West and what they would find there. And
spoiler.
Yeah, that's next week.
They're going to see a commercial. People have seen these guys on
TV. People have seen the cowboy hat.
Exactly. So, you know, they're going to go to Montana. So, we had to plan that even thinking about how many times. Probably, I think two was the easiest, right? Because it was emotional, straightforward. But three was a real twisty, because three was about. You know, how the witness got her groove back, and you actually got to see Olivia become the witness. Yeah, she started, like, even she had doubt.
So, let's talk about that for a second. Because I pride myself on trying to figure out what y'all are going for before we get there. I'm trying to figure it out as the episodes progress. You got me with Olivia. You got me when that moment, she's talking to Cassie in the cell. I'm sitting there going, she doesn't want this baby. She definitely doesn't want this baby. And then we get back and we discover she wants the baby. Her mom doesn't want her to have it.
Right.
That's the kind of moment you guys pull. How do you pull something like that? Even for I mean, the casual viewer is one thing, but I mean, we sit here.
We just
figure it out.
Typical 12 monkey reverse forward engineering, where it's like, you know, you have these things and you have a general idea of where they're going, but then you have to make them fit, not just fit, but sort of like perfectly. So the timelines have to add up, the character moments, the sequence of events that we've seen in terms of like things like Ramsay and all that other stuff, all the character interactions, like the story we do has to fit in all that and make, you know, sense. So that I was one where it was like, and then on top of that, there's just basic storytelling, which is like, you know, in that one, Terry's like, we need to have this twist where we see it, like, we think it's going one way, and then it becomes the other. So,
it's kind of the anti-Ethan story, in which we go back, and Ethan was struggling, like, I don't really think I'm a demon, I don't really want to do these things, but Olivia's like, fuck yeah, I'll be a demon.
Which I think is maybe why I was willing to go for it. I'm looking at redemption with Ethan, where's our redemption with Olivia?
Right, which I think is the reason Cassie, you know, had a chance to strangle her and was like, oh, maybe this is the same story about what happened, and we're all caught in the cycle. Well, yes, they're caught in a cycle, but Olivia is definitely a demon.
I mean, speaking of those cycles for a second, we, in episode 3, we see Olivia have a conversation with her future, future Olivia.
Right.
Where
you see at the end of that episode.
Right.
Where, like, I'm going to do all these things. Yeah.
Right, where and she has a lot of questions of, you know, why are you putting me through all this? Like, you know what's happening. What it's like, and she gets sort of the first glimpse of Titan has a larger purpose than just to be a city that time travels.
Right.
And we see it explode in her vision. And we don't get a lot of clues in that, but we also see her coming into her own as a tyrant. You know, she's killing followers that don't fully believe in her.
Yeah.
And then we see her, we see her have Deacon, which we haven't even talked about that yet. That horrible moment.
So this moment where they leave Deacon behind, they don't really leave him behind. He knew the risks. He left, in my opinion.
Which, by the way, he gets a great hero moment for the like to earn that scene. He gets a great hero moment where he takes out the tower on Titan.
That's true. Yeah. That's a great moment. But it's the kind of thing I gotta tell you. When you guys hit the emotional beats, you hit it hard. Because that moment where he's staring through and he's like, don't leave me.
I didn't know Todd could cry.
Well, you know, Deacon's had, you know, if you look at things from Deacon's perspective, first, you can't forget that the guy is Deacon of the West Seven. This was not a great guy. None of these guys were great guys. And so that's an important thing. And two, you know, he really he's not on the word of the witness. You know, his purpose, he doesn't feel like he really has a purpose other than, you know, he's kind of along for the ride. And then I think, you know, at that moment, you know, it's him truly realizing, well, first he was in love with Cassie, you know, that whole thing. It's him realizing, maybe I don't belong. And the only person who's given him a kudos or a pat on the back has been Olivia, who's like, you're wasted. I see that you're wasted. You're amazing. So it was important, I think, for us to, you know, I think maybe we defanged him a bit in last seasons, and now it's kind of like, don't forget who he is.
And, you know, it never strikes me, or it always strikes me when we see, when Cole walks in, he grabs her, Cassie, and leaves. He doesn't even say goodbye to Deacon. And that moment, for me, it's one of those things where you realize how much he's in for Cassie. And then you go to the next episode where he and Cassie are on completely different pages on what they want. Cassie wants revenge on Olivia. Cole says, I got the new mission, which is the endgame mission, which is he's kind of back with Jones after everything that Jones did to him and Cassie last season. So writing those together, finding a way to work those together, you know, how do you approach this set of characters that's so deeply ingrained and then break them apart and then the third episode bring them back again?
Well, I think, you know, there's also, you know, the value of time. I mean, I think once they splintered, they had Jones healed her stab wound she got from Olivia. So there's been some times and some drinks that they could have to say bygones be bygones. But it's kind of like a fucked up family where you can have the worst fight with your brother or your mother or your father, but you're still family. And, you know, you still are forced to, and they are united and they both don't want the apocalypse to happen. So I think it's that. But and I think I would also say that these arguments, these perspectives come out in the writer's room, and that at least we try, that it's like, you should be like, yeah, let's go back and kill. Why not go back and kill Olivia? Let's talk 8 hours.
I mean, these are all the questions we're asking all the time. It's like, why don't you just go back and kill her? Make it easy. Like, you know, and then you have to, you know, obviously for us, logically have to have good reasons why. And I think we've done that, and that, you know, the time travel logic of it is solid. But it's also too, when the stakes are so high, behaviors in the moment become forgivable because it's all about these issues that are just so much larger than, you know, whatever they're dealing with in the moment.
And I think there's virtue both ways. Is when you're, as an audience member watching, when you're watching the show, it's great when there are those moments when you can clearly be on team A or team B and emotionally invest yourself in one path. And then it's also great when you can see the logic of both. Because it makes our characters, you know, gives our characters agency and intelligence and investment in both plans. And, you know, whoever decides to do whichever path, they're not an idiot. They're doing it for very sound reasons, and you're not making fools of the people that you're writing.
So. Right. I mean, and again, we force ourselves in that room to ask all the questions, the time travel questions, like, why not go back? Okay, we knew Olivia was a kid back in the 1960s. You could go. We had to argue why. Well, and that's a 12 Monkeys facility, and the messenger woman was there. It's not a good idea to go back to that period of time. Why not go back? So we are. I mean, I don't know, Casey. What's it like? I mean, you must. You sit. You must hear a lot of arguments coming out of the writer. What's the thing? They get kind of loud, right? What is that like to?
Yeah, it's great. I always appreciate listening in, and my desk was right outside the writer's room, and it would get heated, but like in the best way, because everyone was so passionate about it. Each person had great ideas, and I think in the end it came down to, I think everyone ended up agreeing on the final decision.
What's the most heated argument we've ever had about...
Well, is it something?
Episode 6.
Well, you should wait on that one. Yeah.
Well, there's two moments in episode 6 I can imagine causing.
406 tonally was my. My fault.
There are two moments. We can't say. We'll go into it next week. There's two moments in episode 6 where I'm like, I can imagine two particular arguments where I can imagine just.
Yeah. Yeah,
I bet those were
getting thrown.
We'll discuss this next week. I'll guarantee those weren't the arguments.
Yeah, those probably were not the arguments. We'll talk about that.
You mentioned the time.
It's a great episode, though. You guys are gonna love it.
You mentioned the time travel logic of it all, and you know, speaking of the time travel logic, you know, Titan has a purpose, and one of the things we learned that it can do is it can allow Olivia to basically become a false primary, in some way, and sort of plug herself into the time stream, which is epic in and of itself, but she also has the power to take over minds and bodies, which is something that Jennifer doesn't have that power unless
which we kind of saw a little bit, those black eyes with in Cassie's head when the witness is in episode 2. We had to pay off everything you had seen or you knew about the witness in previous seasons. We knew the witness had to be this, and I just think, for my money, it's the coolest thing to be able to go back and watch season 1 and 2 and realize you're watching the origin story of the villain and you don't even know it. And she doesn't even know it. Like, the fact that she didn't know
she
was
the witness. Did you know from the pilot that she was the witness?
No. No, but I did.
How did you go
back? I knew at the end of season 2. Well, I remember being on set with Sean, and I was like, I think it has to be Olivia, because I don't think, and then we, although I definitely went down the path of Ethan being the true witness, but it just, it's like, do you really want to watch a show in which the end goal is killing your kid? Because you can't do the Darth Vader turn him back story for two more seasons. It would just be redundant. So, and it just didn't feel right. And so, and I remember we were actually watching Allison, and I'm like, it makes perfect sense. She hates the witness. How great would it be to find out she hated herself?
Yeah. I mean, you'd watch her on screen and she had very limited screen time, especially in season one. And you're just like, she's so great. And, you know, and then you start having those conversations like, are we going to hinge the entire series, not just the season, but the entire series on this character that, you know, is, you know, some people were very divided on. And you just watch it and you'd see her place in the story and be like, it's got to be her.
And I remember sitting at the monitors with you, Terry, when we were filming 303, when they torture her for the first time in the time machine. Yeah. And just that one shot where she turns and the blood runs in her
teeth. Yeah,
and
the kind of
just grim joy that she played in that moment. And it was that moment that we were just like, I remember you and I jumping up and down, like, this is going to work. This is going to work.
We knew we had to earn that story, that twist at the end of season four, because how many times can you be like, the witness is this person? The witness is this person. So
I didn't believe it, like, when we find out Olivia's the witness, there's going to be another turn.
No,
it's
going to
be another 100%. Turn. It can't be. No way.
Well, I think the goal was, of course it is. Yep. It had to be that. And you just didn't want, but you know, we definitely explored versions of it's their son and he's a lunatic and it's a very, but it's a very, very dark.
But
dark
the fun thing path. About his story was that seeing it and realizing, oh, we actually like that guy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, oh, he's not at all what we thought. So that helped, you know, once you do that, then it has to be somebody else.
Yeah.
So you talk about twists. Let's talk about the fact that Jennifer no longer has her primary powers. But how long have you known that, and what does that mean for her?
Well,
poor thing.
We just thought we needed to, you know, in season three, she is drawing and telling people, here's where people are in time, and you needed to take that power away in order to make that character, you know, be like, she, you know, I'm going to be smart and I'm going to be me. But I'm also, I've lost my superpower. I've lost the thing that they, you know, that they rely on me for. And that felt like just a great character opportunity to take Jennifer to a new place.
And I liked seeing where it went with her going, grabbing the Ouroboros and then...
Ouroboros.
Ouroboros. I didn't know the Alaskan lights there.
I thought it there for a minute.
Season five. No, but season five would have been the Northern Lights were connected to temporal disturbance.
Right.
Yeah.
It's fun watching people misspell Ouroboros.
Yeah, it is
on documents and emails.
It was fun watching ourselves misspell it over and over in draft after draft.
Do you know how many times I had to Google that word while just writing the notes for this show?
It's getting the U's in the right place. That's what's fun.
Right, right.
I mean, we called it the cryptex a lot.
Cryptex.
It's a cryptex.
So we see Jennifer's story progress, and I really enjoyed the moment at the end of episode two where she falls back into that train. And you see her look up. You know, we as the audience know, okay, she's looking at the time. But there's a part of me that goes, but would they? Would they actually maybe make her not get rescued? And then, of course, future asshole shows up, saves the day.
It's the ultimate schmuck bait, but I think actually what's valuable.
Would you have done that if you did? Because I assume you knew how these were going to air. Would you have done that?
Yeah.
That twist.
We didn't know how. We didn't know how this was going to air.
So you thought there might be.
Who knows? We don't know.
She's not actually dead.
No, you just end. I don't know how she gets out of that. You know, it's got to be some time travel thing, but it's just a great
schmuck bait. But it's emotional schmuck bait because you know by the end of that episode, whatever the result of it is, it's a gesture of trust in herself that she has been building toward.
Exactly.
So regardless of I'm not alone. You see the outcome,
I'm smart. I'm gutsy. Yeah. I'm all the things that my cloak and dagger Dabney Coleman version of myself told me. Yeah. So
and it gives you a nice way to get Bonham back into it as well.
Yeah,
sense
Bonham.
Of like it really gives you the hook where he picks up the, you know, she forgot the mm-hmm. you know, I mean, typical Jennifer, forgets she actually forgets the thing that she was supposed to, you know, in the midst of her yeah. great idea, she forgets.
Also, the music just you know, you're reminding me as you talked that the music in that scene, that sort of winding thing that starts slow and starts to build mm-hmm. that
yeah.
bum 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 bum.
Sounds like a clock.
Bum bum bum, and it just grows and grows and grows. You're like, someone's gonna die.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't, it's yeah.
I think actually that was a key thing of this season was actually I think was at all times to sort of, even if we knew something is going to be, you know, like go a different direction to what you're expecting, is like pretty much it's, you know, we were often trying to not be ahead of it and sort of, you know, tip the hat to where we were going. And I think that's a sort of, that becomes kind of more crucial even later down the
definitely
line.
Down
because it's yeah. like you can't, it's at the moment, and we've even talked about particular cues and particular moments without even saying what they are, where it's like, where we're like, no, we can't do that bit of music because you'll totally guess
what's what the happen. Thing is yeah
I mean, and even when we've titled things on the seat on the album, I mean on the we've had to you know, we've had to very much kind of be careful about giving things away, largely because you've had that process of setting the framework out for everything that happens in the season.
Yeah.
It's like, but have you ever snuck in something little?
There are little hints.
Yeah, there are little hints.
There are little clues here and there.
Musically,
and it's,
yeah.
And it's sort of...
There, but know. There's nothing... I mean, I could say with confidence, I mean, we're very lucky to have Steven because, first of all, the amount of original music that it, per episode is massive. I can't think of another show that has this much score and feature... film quality. So just finding Steven and being so collaborative, for him to be like, work on a cue for a week, and then I sit down, I'm like, yeah, it's close, and, you know, and then he's so collaborative, and actually the first composer I've ever worked with, you're like, where I would be like, I just think it needs to hurt more, and you're like, oh yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. All right, give me, let me take another whack. Like,
yeah.
Some composers are like, well, I hurt. Go screw yourself, you know. But the music, and when you hear this, the soundtrack will be available on iTunes. I highly recommend it because there's nothing like in the Four Seasons what this score is this season. It's just it really deserves all the accolades it could possibly get.
There are two particular things we haven't talked about yet. Well, the first one is when we find out that that Project Karen has time jumped them back to before the first
to the beginning.
Jump.
Yeah.
Cole gets to see Ramsey again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, damn.
Yeah.
And
was this always part of the picture?
I mean, yeah. that was a fun day in the room because we knew we were going to splinter the facility somewhere else, like laterally. But then it's like, wait a minute, what if they went back in time earlier
to season one?
And it was just like, fuck, like everything, like all the things we did, not gonna spoil anything, but like we can now revisit and look at it a different way. And that was just like, I mean, first and foremost, we're sort of fans and nerds of the show in the room while we're making it.
Yeah.
So we just love that.
And we love the idea that the grocery list of scenes that gives you that you just want to write and see of moments of, oh, I get to see this. We can do
Dr. Eklund.
We can see Eklund. We can do, like, it's just there. And in a weird way, like you're saying, it's 402 in a strange way was the most sort of fluid and natural of the first
scripts. It's a love letter. Episode two is why I wanted to direct that one. Was it's a love letter to the show, and so you got to see everybody, but also you got to do little things like the fact that the core didn't work well in season one was because they were there borrowing from themselves, and that's just so satisfying, and the kind of thing you only get to do. On a serialized time travel show. I haven't really seen that before, so...
It's also a technical feat as well, because, I mean, there's moments where I'm like, well, wait, what footage is this from? Like, I mean, there's new angles, but I'm like, but it looks the same.
Well, we had to.
Really, I mean,
yeah.
Well, we had to shoot episode two first because we were going to fuck up the facility after Project Splinter, after Project Karen, rather, was beams and things on and broken things. So we had to go. We didn't be that far ahead.
Yeah. And plus mining all the old footage mm-hmm. of stuff that we had to, like, you know, piece out and connect with. And
yeah.
And it's also just this strange, lovely, one of the things I love about that episode is the way that it only in this show can you kill off two characters in the episode before and have them come back in the episode
and
you get to say goodbye, the goodbye that you didn't get to say in the previous episode.
It's just a really lovely.
And the goodbye between Cole and Ramsay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you like Ramsay again. You're like, I like Ramsay again.
It's like, oh, right, this one, you weren't a dick. Like,
yeah, yeah. You know what, though? Ramsay's had a rough... I mean, look, man, if you got kids, it was a rough thing.
Well, it's the irony of Cole and Cassie doing exactly what he was trying to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Trying to save his family. And now, back to the very start, it's all the same thing. And so you were talking about earlier about how do you find... You want to root for one side, but while simultaneously still liking the other side, and you agree with every decision. I think that's what makes it so enjoyable as a fan
good
to
drama.
Watch and anguishing to watch, because you want one group to fail, but you also can't bear the idea of them failing.
Yeah,
it's easy.
Everybody's
got to
be the hero of their own story, right? So, you know, logically, you have to get why Olivia's doing the thing she's doing, and so.
Yeah, it's very easy to create a villain in mind drama from just wanting to see a bad person do bad things and get defeated. It's more difficult, but I think ultimately more satisfying when the person you're rooting against is a person you can kind of agree with. There's just so much more meat there.
You know, speaking of the things people will do, in episode 3, the one woman assault on the mansion by Cassie.
Yeah.
Holy.
That's my girl.
Well, that was a thing we always talked about. Why not just go to Monkey?
I want Amanda to have an action franchise on this, after all of this, and especially the stuff we'll get to next week. Like, you have turned her into the baddest of badasses.
Yeah. I'm grinning as you're saying this, because I remember when, there was a lot of
training.
A lot of training. But it was also, the boys in season 2 were like, how come all the good, I'm doing a specific voice, but how come all the good action, why is she such a badass now, you know, and because how great is that, the girl next door doctor.
Well, I mean, because literally in the season, I remember in season 2 premiere when all of a sudden out of nowhere, she's just bang, 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 and she just comes like, what the fuck?
And Amanda has ballet experience, right? Mm-hmm. She's been a ballet dancer for years.
Yeah.
So
she's nimble.
Dance is such a great lead into fight sequences.
Yeah, she loved that. I think everybody really loved the doing as much fighting as they possibly could.
Well, and there's that opening fight scene.
Yeah, that's the gun.
The one you showed at Comic-Con.
Gun-fu, yeah.
And the scene that assault leads into, where it's Cassie with the young Olivia and her mother and a future pro.
Yeah.
Present Olivia has taken over. Witness Olivia has taken over past Olivia, now realizing, she's creating the cycle of a day that she... remembers blacking out on, and now she's completing it. And
but she's not actively completing it. She's like, I know how this is gonna go. Here's the bullet. You know what I mean? Like, it only goes one way. We are stuck in this thing. You can't. There's only. We needed to narratively ask and answer that question. Why not go back and do X? Why not go kill somebody when they're in grade school? Why not do this? It's because that. Just doesn't work.
You know, on top of that, I mean, it raises an interesting question I assume you will be getting into later in the season of if they're in these cycles, it's the classic time travel question paradox of what comes first? Mm-hmm. Well, it's like if they ultimately succeed, right? And the virus is stopped and no time travel ever existed. Does that mean then time travel, how they have the time travel to have saved the world, right?
It's a good question. Stay tuned.
You know, you wonder why is Cole not willing to go back and help Cassie save or kill Olivia when you think, okay, she's the witness. You kill the witness, everything's out of the picture. Like, it's not just revenge. But it's great. I think, you know, you're talking about the loops. It's great to see Cassie realize in that moment that she does essentially try to kill Olivia. But fails.
Yeah.
And that moment she gets back and she says, I get it now. I understand we're in that loop. And then you get her and Cole back on the same page. And you said it earlier, the show's about Cole and Cassie. It works best when they're on the same page.
Yeah. I think.
And they're finally there, and that's kind of how we end. And then they hug, of course, which I have to tell you, her going into that Splinter chair and not actually hugging him goodbye at the end of episode two.
You know what's funny is I never think
about how the ship is going to take
I never do because we're not.
That means so much.
We're not, because I think inherently Sean and Chris, we're not really shippers. We're just, we tell the story, and the love story is a component of it. So we never think about those things. And then, like, you get on Twitter and they're like, why didn't he say I love you? Why didn't he do this? I'm like, yeah, but there's very high stakes. The world is about to end. Those people, literally his other self is in another room and Ramsey could come in. So, you know, we just don't think about that. But it's interesting.
And ultimately, if writers, you did and if you gave them those moments,
they might not come back.
Then they'd be devalued and then you'd be doing them a disservice.
Right.
And so you know, when they do hug at the end of season three, or the episode three, you're like, okay, we're good. We're all back on the same plane. We're all good. We're back on the same page. And it does mean that, you know, physically and metaphorically.
Yeah, that kind of, all of that discussion kind of takes us to the end of the first block of episodes. And before we go, I want to talk more about the score. You know, what was like your favorite moment of like these first three episodes?
Wow.
The score?
I think probably my favorite moment is actually where it quietens down in the first episode, because just you come back in and it is just this train ride that just, it's just absolutely goes, you know, balls to the wall right for the first sort of 25 minutes. And then when you finally get to that, and there's that final of the moment, and they come back into they see the machine and the ruins and
everything. It's a great piece.
Mm-hmm. And there's this sense of sort of, you know, like, you know, oh, you know, what on earth are we going to do now? Like, yeah, and that, I think there's the calms after the storms for the, you know, like, pretty much throughout the season.
And you had an original song with Kelsey too. Yeah. That you guys wrote for that song as they're walking through the apocalypse was a fun,
and it's not something you often get to do, and it's sort of, you know, we have a sort of good reason for it as a piece of source, but it's you know, where those moments where you can try and find something that speaks to the sort of, I mean, it's the weight of three full seasons and then one episode, and you're just sort of, you know, like, where, I mean, it, I think it just gives you this really nice sense of, like, you know, like, where are we going to go from here?
And yeah, I love that it's a love song, because Kelsey and Stephen wrote this obviously for this specific show, but that the lyrics are a love song about here we are again back at the end. It's just perfectly set in the world of loops, and it thematically works great in that.
And
apocalypse.
Casey, I'm curious, when you were watching the season play out in the writer's room from the outside, and you were watching them develop the first block of episodes in particular, like, what was your reaction as they were building these? Like, was it just a whirlwind of insanity, or was there a track you could follow?
No, it was all pretty careful. You know, they would have ideas, and then it would be run through, like, okay, does this make sense? And they would track it very carefully. So I thought it was really a treat to see everyone, because, like I said before, like, everyone was really passionate about, like, not only the story, but the characters, everyone, because the characters are so awesome, and you just really feel for each one. And so it's like everyone was just wanted to do it justice in the end. And so, and then technically, they also wanted to do it justice as well, because there were so many just like loops and circles, and so everyone got involved in making sure that everything lined up, like, exactly.
But
we were always checking ears.
It's funny, as you're telling this story, I'm watching just like pained look on Sean's face of like how many times where I'm like, I think we got to go back and sit down and talk about this one, because it this season was really, and by the way, it's how hard it is makes it the most worthwhile. Yeah. I think it's like when you finally have cracked it, and sometimes you don't even really know you've cracked it until the cut, you know what I mean, until the music is on it, but it's like once you've cracked it, it feels really good. But these were very hard, because you knew the end, we're here, the end is, you're paying things off now, and you've got one shot to do it, and so the pressure is, I think, more than mm-hmm. ever before.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it liberating or is it constricting that you know that this is the final season, that you have to solve all the answer the questions.
It's both. I mean, you don't, first of all, you don't, a lot of shows don't get the chance to do that. And we knew we were going to do it 20 episodes. We were like, we're going to finish this, which is amazing. But in a serialized time travel show, you know, it's the setups and payoffs of those mysteries and making sure, you know, you don't want all the answers to just come at the last 5 minutes of the thing. And you're like, oh, here, we just made up some stuff and here you go. And here, the corpse in the night room is the janitor you met. And you know what I mean? And so like,
it had to be
organic for the four seasons.
I mean, you'd have times where, like, you know, talking about like sitting in the writer's room where you have, you know, everyone, like, we've come up with a great idea that everybody loves, and then that moment comes, you realize, oh wait, that doesn't fit in the timeline.
Yeah.
Oh, you'd have entire days of discussion go up in smoke because one person asks, well, what if you went back and did this? And it's like, well, shit, let's start over. You know?
They couldn't have done that.
Guess we're ordering dinner tonight. Yeah. The kiss of death.
Well, honestly, all right, let's get the dinner menus in here. How many late nights were there writing this one? Were there not?
Every night.
By season four, it got hard. We were also exhausted too. And I'm amazed. I look at season four. I didn't think we could beat season three quality wise, and we did with season four. Like, season four is
so good.
This is
definitely
the
best season. Oh, yeah.
Season three to me is about as perfect as, and not to toot our own horns here a bit, but it was like, you know, it's about two parents trying to save their kid. It's a perfect setup, you know, for great drama. But this one was, yeah, we were exhausted because we had just done that season. And if I was a more veteran showrunner, when they said, because they were like, you can do these back to back, I would have said, we're going to shoot season three and we're going to take 3 months off. And then we'll come in, we'll have reasonable hours. And it was in the budget to do that. But I was getting certain pressures from certain producers, like, yeah, but you'll save some money if you don't. You'll lose crew people if you don't. And we're like, we can do this. And at the top of 20 episodes, we're like, guys, network shows are 22. Fine. But producing this show is the other thing. We spend a tremendous amount of time on set with Sean and Chris. And we've lived in Toronto. We have lived in the apocalypse of icy snows.
Set, and the weirdest fucking thing about that set is, when I came for that set visit in season two, we came in the mornings. In the morning, we went in, we did the whole day. We come out, the sun has set. And it's a dark set. People don't know this, but that set is legitimately, it's hard to walk around on that set.
Yeah. After season one, I went to go see my doctor, and he's like, you have tremendous vitamin D deficiency. And he's like, you just need to go outside and be in the sun.
That was a year ago. I'm still taking vitamin D.
Yeah, me too. Those mega blue pills.
Yes.
So, I think it's worth finishing up this recording episode. I want to know your favorite moments in this block that we watch tonight. When you rewatch it, what moment do you watch and go, that's it, that's the moment right there, that's my favorite?
Oh, for me, I think there's tremendous, it's really two. I mean, there's tremendous satisfaction, I think, in Deacon blowing the smokestack. I just think that's a big
timber.
That's just a big blockbuster.
Because it was
popcorn.
Your idea. Come on, face it. It was your idea.
It was also my idea. No, it's just a big blockbuster popcorn moment, and you know, it was tremendous fun to sort of just be able to do that. And then, so much of 402 is heartbreaking to me, and I. You know, Jones and Cole Ramsey, and that's just one of the most emotional episodes I think we've done. And there's no one moment there. I think just as a piece, I think it speaks to me.
Sean?
You know, it's I don't have a particular favorite moment, but what I loved about the show is that, you know, like, in the span of three episodes, got to have scenes in medieval times and then have like Baltimore City street kids living in a
squalor,
in a squatting, you know, so like that to me is like the fun thing, that you can have these things that are so incredibly different.
But Olivia mainlining, I would have
the same mythology,
but Olivia putting on the mask, I would have thought.
There's all those, like, you know, all the fun thing at the end of three is how we like, you connect all the pieces from all these previous seasons and you see, oh, they all fit, but it was always fun on this show to get to do such wildly different things in the same context of this one story.
What about you, Case?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I really love Jones. I love Jones. Just everything that she does, I think, is great. And I think
so. When you get two of them,
it's awesome. And I love that it was like the ultimate like catharsis as well. Talking to yourself, like forgiving yourself, and also like encouraging yourself. You know, showing. Recognizing your own faults and your own strengths, and that gives her the strength to go on as well. I thought that was really pretty.
And also on that scene, I adored when Cole and Jones have to run away quickly and they hide out
in her room while she's sleeping.
And she says, oh, don't worry about her, she's completely sauced.
Yeah, that's good.
Probably Olivia mainlining, I would say.
Yeah.
Just because I think I think that's one of those moments where you feel there's a jigsaw puzzle coming together, and it's that sort of there's a large chunk of it just suddenly falls into place. And you know, he says, "Oh, you know, here's the mask. I had it modified. I thought it was appropriate."
And the song,
and I was
too.
Like,
"Yeah."
And I'm like,
"Yeah, that song that she repeats that she plays in the 45. Yeah, awesome.
It just tells you straight away that you know, like, oh, this is going to come together. Yeah. This isn't just you know, like, and I think that's what you know, like, it's the beginning of a lot of that.
Yeah.
Terry?
Without question for me, my favorite moment of that is is Jones and Cole watching the first splinter and, you know, coming full circle and seeing the beginning of their journey, and it's emotional, and we know she's dying and she's like, I just want to see the end of this. As they're watching the beginning, it's thematic and the score has never been better. And it's just, it might be my favorite moment. The finale has some of probably my favorite moments of the series, but that is about as perfect. And we got, you know, I was also there on set for both of those, like for the actual first splinter, and to come back and watch it again. So it's, you know, emotional for me.
What was yours?
Little things like seeing Deacon when he's asking them not to leave him behind. That to me is such a progression, because I honestly, Deacon drove me nuts. He drove me nuts for the first couple, you know, most of the time that we've known him, but then watching him be able to soften up, knowing what Cassie's done, seeing his relationship with Jennifer, but then seeing that moment where he says, don't leave him behind, it just speaks so much to his character. And it ultimately plays out, I think, hopefully in the rest of the season. But there's a little thing, you know, again, Jennifer flopping across the museum floor. I'll never forget that. That's the great thing. But I, you know, you talk about emotional payoff moment. I honestly, Casey, you say you love Jones, and I think I said this on Twitter recently. I've never been a huge Jones fan.
See, I don't get that.
See, I don't know if I get it either. But I think it comes
Jones
down
is
to
the
what
best.
I think it comes down to what Chris was
People
saying.
People have
about
a
how
hard time with Germans.
No.
That's what it is.
See you next week. You want one side of the wind.
Right, exactly. But what were you going
to
say?
I think it has to do with, you know, you want one side of wind and the other, and then Jones and Cassie were never on the right side, and I was with Cassie the whole run, and then they kind of get on the same page. But seeing that moment where with the whole fight sequence that's going on, which we saw at Comic-Con, and then seeing it cut in with Jones going to the core, accepting the radiation and the music that led up to it, to me, that's the point where I go, shit, Jones.
Oh, she sacrificed.
All right, I'm on board.
Yeah,
I'm with you now. Yeah. Whatever you want, wherever you're going,
She's a different Jones, because, and I think you see it in two now. She's like, look, you know, there's no mission. It's what we decide. You know, and so I think that's a good place to, you know, for her to be this new Jones. So we'll see.
What about you, Meryl?
One woman assault on the mansion. I mean,
Amanda Shull would love you for that.
It was very well shot.
Look, I'm a huge fan of action movies and espionage movies, and you know, she went full John Wick, and it was just. I mean, it felt like the ending of her training was like that moment of like, okay, she's now full blown, like, Cole could fuck off and she'd be fine.
She'd love you for that too.
You know what's funny is there's only one take where it was raining. And it was, and they were like, "We're gonna wait for the rain." I was like, "No, shoot now in the rain! You know how cool this is gonna look when the steady came with the rain." And so we actually had to digitally add rain to some of the later shots because
we just add money to your budget, Terry. Just,
you know how cool is that? She's pouring rain. She just pulls out her silencer and starts. Pop, pop, pop. I mean, that was the only take we had of that. I think it was like the first take too, but yeah.
And so, yeah, before we go, what do you want to tease about the next three episodes coming up next
week? The next three episodes are The Adventures of Project Splinter. It is just a great night of TV, of and you guys, I know you guys have already seen it, but it is 4, 5, and 6 are the most fun.
They're like three adventure.
Three
like
giant time travel adventures. Mm-hmm. You're all in this, you know.
And they're all completely different.
Yeah. And it has all the emotion, but it's like, and it's probably your last chance to have fun, probably, before it gets real
That's
serious.
Fun. Oh, you guys are in for it.
But it is I mean, it's a great night of TV.
It's our most Raiders-y.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You know what? So that's going to do it for this episode of Talking Monkeys. You know, join us next week when we talk about episodes 4, 5, and 6.
Night 2. Yeah. Boom.